This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Young adult novels such as Harry Potter and the Twilight series broke all sorts of profit records for book sales, and they've made wizards and vampires a nationwide sensation. Frances O'Rourke Dowell's books may have the same target audience, but they're stories of a very different breed. In her newest book, she's tackling very real themes like childhood obesity and bullying, and she embodies them in her heroine, who is both overweight and bullied. The Second Life of Abigail Walker has received very warm reviews so far, and Frances O'Rourke Dowell joins me now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about this new book.
This new book is about an 11-year-old girl named Abigail. She goes by Abby. She is part of the medium group of girls, and she is sort of the lowest on the totem pole. And she gets bullied, she's mistreated, and she puts up with it because she doesn't want to be outside. She feels like being part of a group is necessary to her social survival. And then one day she decides it's not. And she walks away from the group of girls, which makes them very unhappy, but it changes her life.
And she meets some people who themselves are on the outside.
She meets a number of different people who are. One of the first people to befriend her once she has left is a boy in her class named Anoop, who is a quiet and shy boy who plays what he calls football during recess with other boys, the skinny and the scrawny and the fat and the round, and they play soccer in the furthest field. And he befriends Abigail, and what she's amazed by is that he seems to accept her just as she is, and that to her is an overwhelming and kind of new feeling. So that's one of the first people she befriends.
And then Anders.
And then Anders, who... Abigail is being chased down her street, and she suddenly a dog appears and seems to be leading her and leads her to a creek. And there's a boy at the other side of the creek who says, "Come on over." And she crosses the creek, and they run together up the hill, and the dog magically is on the other side of the hill when they get there. And Anders is a 9-year-old boy who is being homeschooled and whose father is recently home from Iraq and who's dealing with some post-traumatic stress. And they live on a farm with Anders' grandmother.
And if we haven't said it by now, the fact is that Abby, the reason she's being bullied, part of it is because she's overweight.
Right, right. She weighs 17 pounds more. And when you're in sixth grade, maybe when you're in 60th grade, I don't know, you know how much more. But she knows, and that's one of the things that the girls in her group really go after her about.
And, of course, she internalizes all that, as you said. She knows she needs to be part of that group, and that group is 17 pounds lighter than her.
Right,
right. And
right.
That, and she can't imagine anything else. And now her world is being opened up by these other possibilities.
Right.
About being accepted. Will you read for us?
I will. I will read a couple pages from Chapter 3, and I don't think they need intro. I think it'll be clear what's going on. Riding the bus home that afternoon was an exercise in sitting very still while a swarm of bees hummed behind her ears. Kristen and Georgia were buzzing about Abby's turncoat behavior, how she was lucky they'd been her friends at all, and now nobody would be her friend. Who would want to be friends with a fatty like Abby? Abby squirmed uncomfortably in her seat. The girl next to her, a fifth grader named Sonia, scooched closer to the window, and Abby flushed, wishing she didn't take up so much space. She squeezed her thighs closer together, sat up straighter, sucked in her cheeks. "Did you hear her say medium when Mrs. Moser asked what size shirt she needed for the chorus recital?" Kristen asked in a super loud voice. "Medium, that's a joke. Extra large would be more like it." Abby stared intently at the head of the boy in front of her. He had three calyces that she could see, and one was sticking straight up. Did he care? Did he stand in front of the mirror in the morning and rub hair gel on top of his head to try to make the calyces lie down? Did it bug him when someone asked him what size shirt he wore? Did he lie about being a medium, even when he knew he was really a large? Did he dread the day in P.E. when they got weighed like pumpkins at the state fair and everyone listened as hard as they could when the teacher told her assistant what numbers to write down in the record book? Probably not. First of all, he was a boy, and Abby was pretty sure boys didn't care about stuff like hair and shirt sizes. She had two brothers, so she knew this from firsthand experience. And second, from what Abby could see, he was a regular-sized kid. He probably didn't give it a second thought when they got weighed in P.E. What would that be like, Abby wondered, not to care, to walk up to the scale, still joking around with your friends behind you, not noticing as the PE teacher fiddled with the marker, pushing it farther to the right, and then a little farther, the number getting higher and higher. She bet he didn't stand there with his eyes shut tight, his stomach churning, praying that he'd magically lost 10 pounds overnight. I don't know why we started being friends with Abby in the first place, Kristen said from behind her. What a waste of time.
Frances O'Rourke Dowell reading from her latest novel, The Second Life of Abigail Walker. So much going on in that passage. First, the shorthand that kids use to create identities. You're a medium, you're a large, you're a small. Obviously, Abby's internalization and trying to find comparisons for her to create her own identity. But what's the most fascinating for me is the girls who are in some ways worried or angry that she would dare leave their group.
Right.
Their whole power, right, is based on everybody believing in the importance of their hierarchy.
Right, right. And that's, I think it is so much about power. I mean, at that age particularly, these girls are in sixth grade. It's about social order. It's like, where do you fit in? Who are you? But it's also, you know, in those late elementary years for girls, suddenly realizing, oh, we can control people. We can manipulate people. And it's exciting. And when somebody walks away, it is infuriating. It's like, wait a minute, we can't control you? No, we can. We will.
And of course, there are a lot of ways to create those hierarchies and put you down the ladder. You chose to make Abby overweight. Why?
I was overweight. I've struggled with my weight all my life. And I go to schools a lot and do, you know, talk about my books. And I see these girls who I just feel are me. You know, they're always sitting there with a book and they're very sweet. And, I always send them like these love bombs, like, you're great. You're great. I don't know if it does any good, but I do it. But anyway, I thought, you know, this is something that was really a part of my childhood. And I would like to write about this. And I would like to write in a way that will somehow comfort or make these girls feel stronger. And so that's what I sat down. And that was the one thing I knew about the book when I started writing, that this character would be overweight.
And you create this world in which young girls can be so mean and cruel and use this power. And then, of course, for boys, it's different. They're in there, the outcast boys. Is it very different for you or difficult for you to get into that universe of young men and the way they both exert their power and then cope with being on the outside? Because it is different, isn't it?
It is different. I think with boys, it is more physical. It's about size, but in a different way. It's about height and muscles. It's interesting. I have two sons, and that allows me some insight. They're both doing pretty well, and I'm not worried about them, but they're very different. My younger son, I think, is more social, and it's easier for him. But my older son, fortunately, is very self-confident. So, but it's interesting watching him maneuver as well and see how they get along and how they – but it's really different from how girls work.
And boys, when they are self-confident, don't feel the need – I mean, they might lord it over you. Maybe they'll be the bully. But they don't form little aggregations of
they don't. Cruelty. And I think it's more – they don't. And that's the difference between boys and girls, as far as I can tell – is that boys are just it's a more physical thing. Yeah. It's a more physically aggressive. And with girls, it is emotional and psychological, and you can't see the wounds. You can't, you know, and it makes it harder to talk about. And I mean, I think bullying for both boys and girls is a shaming thing. Yeah. But with girls, again, it's just
the techniques are very different.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So tell us about the character of the fox in this book.
The fox showed up in an early draft very briefly to bite Abby in a field. And I don't know why the fox showed up. The fox just kind of showed up. I'm like, oh, there's a fox. What will we do with this fox? And and the fox does very lightly bites Abby. And Abby believes that this has changed her, that this has turned her into a new person. And I thought that's all the fox needed to do. But my editor said, no, actually, I like this fox. I would like to see more of the fox. The fox is kind of a time traveler. That's what she does. She goes in and out of stories. One of the things that started becoming clear to me is that this fox in some ways was a mirror for Anders' father, Matt. Matt was in Iraq. He was in a car bombing. He miraculously survived it. Well, as it turns out, the fox was there too. And the fox is also having post-traumatic stress. And which I didn't quite realize for a while, like, oh, this fox is really, you know, has been traumatized. And I thought, well, this is interesting because it allows me to explore that in a way that might be less intense if it was all focused on Matt, on this grown man right. in the story, who does exhibit, you know, and is sometimes a little frightening to Abigail. He gets very intense at times. But it was the fox became more of a way to really think about some of this stuff.
And this element of magic in some way, the mm-hmm. idea that this bite was magic and transformative, isn't necessarily pure fantasy. This is the way kids, how we cope, why we are resilient, because there's a place to go that's not on this earth.
Right. And things happen. I think especially when you're a child, you can find a feather. I mean, sometimes I find a feather. I think, oh, magic, I found a feather. Yeah. But when you're a child, particularly, you will invest a lot of meaning into that. And so to have a fox bite you and then to later the bite marks disappear and Abigail's like, oh, that means I'm new. You know,
But investing this in something like PTSD, I mean, how did you do that? Because as you said, you were about to let the fox go. So was this something that you had to sort of force on the fox, or did it exhibit these tendencies for you?
I think it exhibited something. Was clearly, you know, when you have a character, you have to give that character a conflict. And at first, I didn't know. I knew this. I was like, why does this fox seem so resistant to eating chickens? There was something about the fox that the fox was clearly having some moral issues, some quandaries, and the fox's concerns. In some ways, it was organic. It just, you know, as because I'd already had Matt's story, because this was a later draft as I'm developing the fox. And I thought, oh, this fox is nervous. This fox is – something's going on with this fox. And then it sort of came clear to me, like, I know what's happening with this fox.
So as you develop this character, the fox, now with PTSD and with a kind of magical quality, does that change Matt at all? Do you see his PTSD in a new way? Did you have to go back in any way?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know that I had to go back, because one of the things – I mean, and that's interesting. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I can go back into the process and pick that out. But one of the things that became clear is that both Matt and the fox are trying to heal themselves. And I think maybe that's what the fox heightened with Matt, and my understanding of that. And one of the things that Matt is trying to write a poem – you know, one of the ways the fox works is to sort of – bring in a spiritual element as well as a magical. I mean, it's, you know.
Right.
And I think Matt is writing this poem about the Lewis and Clark expedition. My son Jack happened to be taking a fifth grade history class. They were studying Lewis and Clark, and we all just got very excited about Lewis and Clark. But the idea of Matt's very interested in the world becoming new, which is actually a promise that some religions made, that at some point the world will be made new. And that's what he becomes very interested in, and that's how he's going to heal himself. And I realize that they have similar projects, that Matt and the fox, and they're trying to get better. They're trying to be healed.
And certainly this is what literature does for kids. It's why they're reading, and they're reading a fair amount. I mean, one of we keep hearing, well, they're playing too many games. But kids are actually buying these books and, we assume, reading them, right? Literature?
One hopes,
yeah.
I think I get letters. I get letters, and I think they are.
And sales are pretty good in general, but even the Harry Potter series, but because kids are really, I mean, this is what young people, we all need, but people need to help cope, grow, and mature to be able to somehow access these irrational qualities, spiritual, magical, call them what you will. Without any outlet or without any way to consume this, it might be pretty hard to make this transition into adulthood.
Exactly. I think you need to, you know, it's funny because you just interviewed Alex, who is a gamer, and I've been reading a lot about gaming and fantasy, and I think a lot about kids who are walking around school being Harry Potter in their mind. You know, that sometimes you need that idea that it gives you an idea that the world is large, the universe is mysterious. It's not all this math test I'm about to take.
Right. Well, and your character, Abigail, is clearly ostracized. She's the outsider. And the notion, especially in young adult fiction, of the ostracized, the outsider, the orphan, somebody alone. I mean, that's a pretty important character for kids to identify with.
Yeah. And I think everyone – feels out like an outsider at one point or another. And a lot of people who would surprise you, people who seem so inside, actually feel very much the outsider. And, you know, one of the things that I think that literature does for children or for all of us, but particularly, you know, when you're a kid, you think you're weird. You don't realize that everyone is weird in the same way. You have these strange thoughts. You don't realize that all kinds of people right. before you for millennia right. have been having your strange, bizarre thoughts or have, you know, walked out of the bathroom with the toilet paper on, all those things. You think it's just you, and it makes you feel alone. And then you read these books, you're like, oh, yeah. oh. It's very powerful.
Right. You become part of this larger world because you are a monster, right? Your body is because your body is changing.
Yes.
It was once this. It's on the way to being that, which is to say, you're neither of those things. And so your body looks freakish. And then, of course, the culture is to make you all the same. And so
yes.
to try to clothe this beast into something that looks like everything else is just a nightmare for
yeah.
kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what you're writing. And your next book, you're writing about gaming, apparently.
I am. I can't talk about it too much because I'm a first draft. But my son, Jack, is a gamer, and I'm fascinated by it because I used to just sort of go, ugh, gaming, ugh. Mm-hmm. You know, and the more he talks about it to me and the more I read about it and learn about it, I find it fascinating because it's storytelling.
Right.
The kind of role-playing games that he does, like World of Warcraft. And it's fascinating. I'm too nervous to actually try playing the games. I asked him the other day. I'm like, so if I play and I'm really dumb, will like they make fun of me? He's like, yeah, they might.
They will. But he'll enjoy that, so give him a break.
Yes. Yeah, no, it'd be fun for him.
And you're right. There is narrative. I mean, they pay people to write these things,
yeah.
to write these stories, to keep them coherent.
Yes. And you're creating a lot of the story yourself. You're making choices. You are a character in a story, and the choices you make affect the story. And you're working with other people. Groups and guilds and whatever to make things happen. So I find it the actual gaming part I'm not so sure about, but the whole everything surrounding it, I'm finding it, the world building, very interesting.
You come out with about a book a year.
I do.
And they're all good.
Well, thank you.
So how do you – are you driven? Do you like say, well, if I'm not writing a book, I'm going to collapse. It won't be me.
I really enjoy writing. I mean, day to day sometimes I don't really enjoy it. But it's kind of what I do. And I like putting sentences down and, you know, and – So I do. I really do think of it as my job, and I feel very fortunate that I make a living doing it, so I better sit down and do it so that I don't, you know, have to do anything else that would involve, like, getting dressed up and flossing. So, yes, but I do. I mean, I sit down every morning, and I work for about 3 hours, and I usually have different projects that I go back and forth on, so if I get stuck, I can hop over to someplace else. But I really love doing it. It's my favorite thing to do, even on days where I feel really stupid and inarticulate.
You have teenage boys now.
I have one of them.
One of them is teenage.
Yes.
So does that help you at all or confuse you when you try to write? Because teenage boys will confuse you anyway.
Well, they can. Well, it's helpful because it puts me more in that world. Mm. So Jack is 13, and it's, you know, like a lot of 13-year-old boys, he's not really spilling his guts to me. Here, let me tell you about my day and all the interesting social interactions I had.
Yeah.
But I'm around more kids that age, and so that's very helpful. To be, you know, you feel, especially to be honest, in this day and age of ever-changing technology, where I had to ask a friend, like for my last book, like, someone's texting. How do they do that? So it's really helpful to have kids.
Yeah.
And they can. And Jack has been great working on this new book that's got a gaming element to ask him about things.
We'll have you back when that comes out.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Frances O'Rourke Dowell's new book, the one that's on the shelves, is called The Second Life of Abigail Walker. She reads tonight at 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. Coming up, Joe Gore and The Alternative bring their gospel sound to our studios. Stay with us on The State of Things.